this material is on the web. And you can find it on my homepage. I have a link with collected things for this workshop. There is also a link there to where to get plugins for BRML, which is what you need to be able to see the 3D renderings. And these are abundantly available for Windows and Mac, and also several are available for Linux. I think there are a few for Unix systems, but not too many. There's good one for Sigma graphics, and I think there's one for Sun. But the best way to see this is simply from a PC, because all PCs today, because kids have games, have terrific 3D engines. So the main problem is downloading these things. They're often a megabyte or more. And for some stupid reason, Windows doesn't understand PC. the text files, and they're packed enormously well. But Windows browsers don't understand how to unpack .brl.gz, so they have to be unpacked. Sorry about that. But I have several of these as files, and I will have to mess around with it to find them. But briefly, this is the summary of work by two PhD students who finished this task. Bill Arontis from Greece. I'm now doing 2 years of military service, so I was asked for a while. And from Thorpe, who's now in Stockholm. And they both worked a little bit on the ABC Dynamo, and then also on the Solar Dynamo. So I'll tell you about the things we learned about ABC Dynamos from their work. Actually, I think you understand pretty much how they work now. So that's a bit inconvenient, but doable. So here's a summary of what I'll show you very briefly. First of all, laminar dynamos. They're excellent for understanding how dynamos work. And you'll come to understand more when I get to the point. But briefly, it's because they are stationary. The flow is stationary, and the growth in this case, the ABC dynamo at large Reynolds number, is steady. It means that the magnetic field is everywhere simply B times e to the gamma t. Grows totally subsimilarly and steadily. And by analyzing the work, which is of course totally ignorable in a kinematic computation, but you can still analyze it, I can come to understand where the growth occurs. And the mystery that has been known for quite some time about the growth rate about these of these dynamos. And from that, we can conclude that the ABC flow is the fast dynamo. Let me put in a story at this point. The difference between a kid and a grown-up is that a kid has an infinite mind. They don't have an overflow. So they remember all these stories. My son was 9, and he has hundreds of stories. And I used to have many of these when I was a kid, and I don't remember any of them. So this one is a test. I think from the book about Ramaz theorem by a BBC journalist, maybe. Anyway, it reminds me of my childhood stories about Dane, a Swede, and an American. And depending on who's telling the story, of course, one is the stupid one, one is the smart one. This is a story about an astronomer and a physicist and a mathematician who goes from England to Scotland. And they look at the door and they find, they see a whole bunch of sheep. They're black. And the astronomer says, hey, that's interesting. In Scotland, all the sheep are black. And the physicist says, no, that's not true. All you can say is that in Scotland, some sheep are black. The astronomer is looking at some. And then the mathematician says, no, all you can say is that in Scotland, some sheep are black on one side.
Yeah.
And I think, okay, it's a kind of story, but it's a good point. That we really should have the physicist point of view of things. What is reasonable? We don't really look for very stringent mathematical proof. But when we understand things, that's what we're looking at. That's what we're aiming for. And that's, in that sense, I understand why the ABC 111 flow is a fast dynamo. Because we can analyze what's going on. The second point is that thermal dynamos are quite similar to laminar dynamos. If, and that's a crucial thing, namely, cranks up the force in these experiments so that the RMS velocity remains the same. Everyone else has done experiments before, kept the force in constant, and that therefore when the flow turns turbulent, the amplitude goes down very much. And that brings in arbitrary effects that you don't really want to have. And the short result is that the growth rate simply is related to the large rate chronometer. And that's been known for many years that this is typically the case. That's also the case for the solar dynamo. The time scale for the solar dynamo is what it takes to wind up the field. In about 11 years, you can wind up the differential rotation of the field about 10 times, or 20, I don't remember. It's a few number of times. Enough to get this radically gauss field that pops up on the surface. And the fact that it's similar to the thermal time is far from trivial, and it's far from obvious when you look at things like the work and the dissipation done. I come back to that. That's sort of the key point about this thing here, the difference in work and dissipation. And as a curiosity, I might have time to mention exactly the position dynamo, where B is not only equal to U, but it's parallel to U. Totally parallel to U, and it's a funny experiment that we fell into by an accident. I'll also show some animations about how a convective pumping works, the thing we got a little bit about yesterday. And then I show some 3D visualizations of the toroidal and field and a model of the solar march and so on. And a little bit of discussion about a speculative explanation for the universal and the sun. Now I have to work this down. Okay. You've gone too many now. So the ABC flow, of course, has this structure, that it's a flow where the x component doesn't depend on x, and instead depends on y and z. And then we permute the three components, and you get something which is extremely symmetric, very symmetric. And in fact, it's so symmetric that the eigenvalues, take a point in space, that's three eigenvectors of this strain tensor, typically. Huh? And so typically those three would be different, and you have three directions. But here you have actually four directions, because two are equal. And so, in principle, you have a circular surface there, when you span out by the eigenvectors. But the nonlinear terms, essentially, you have three directions that are peculiar. And these are perfectly symmetric with respect to rotations. I'll show you that in a while. They're highly symmetric, but they have chaotic Lagrangian properties. And they have this threefold symmetry, and they have the Bertrand property, so that curl is parallel to velocity.
The chaotic properties are really rather weak, aren't they?
Sorry?
The chaotic properties are really rather weak.
Yes, but they're not, actually, to give you a fast answer. And that's interesting.
So you're going to do this with MHT, right?
These things are done with
full MHT equations.
Well, it's kinematic by definition. The MHT flow is a given flow.
All right.
That you simply declare.
Yeah.
But you can still, with a given velocity field, ask for example, what's the work that you would have to do that. And you can compare that work with dissipation, and the difference is the growth rate. The difference is what makes the field grow. And that's the key part. And I shouldn't waste too much time on explaining things that people already know about this thing. Here's just a rendering of those crucial points in space where the eigenvectors are largest. Right? And they fill out the very symmetric crystal pattern that I'll show you in a little while in a 3D rendering. These are traditionally called alpha and beta points. So the other ones are where you have converging flow in two directions and diverging in a third. And this is, of course, compressionless, divergence free. So whenever you have convergence in two directions, you have divergence in a third. And the other points, the blue ones, are the beta points, which are just opposite. So there everything is diverging in two directions and converging along one direction. And the mystery here is how can you arrange the feed lines so that P just grows exponentially. At low magnetic Reynolds number, you get something which is hard to understand because you get a periodic behavior. And that's a little bit difficult to cope with. I think I need to jump so I can at least do some work looking at the screen.
What is the difference between yellow and zoom?
Convergence or divergence in a plane. And that is absolutely crucial for where the magnetic field goes. Very briefly, around those convergence points you get flat cigars, very tight concentration of field. And in the divergent regions you get a complicated mess of reconnection stuff. Let's see, I need to have a copy of a page from... I made this today a bit offline. Why is it not? Yeah, okay, here it is. So here are the growth rates for low and intermediate and high Reynolds number. So for low Reynolds number you have something which is oscillatory, but it's growing secularly on top of that, very slowly. And this is a system where two polarities all the time interchange, so it's difficult to understand. And then as you crank up the Reynolds number, first you go through a window where there's no dynamo action, you come into another window where there's a decreasing period, and finally at some higher Reynolds number you get into a steady growth. And that's the good one, because it's so easy to think about a totally stationary and steady growing system. Okay. So that's the one I'm going to look at a little bit more in detail. And again, I should not waste too much time.
Does this model have resistivity in it?
Yes. And that's absolutely crucial. Absolutely crucial. And that's telling us exactly what's going on. Because the resistivity...
Yeah, reconnection so that you can have...
Yes, so you can have feedback of feedbacks.
Right.
If there wasn't any reconnection, you could get the feedbacks back into the divergent region. That's the trick. And here are some crucial properties, some crucial numbers. The growth rate for the K equals 1 dynamo is about 0.7.
When you went to the high magnetic Reynolds number, what resolution were you using?
Up to 320.
Cubed.
Yeah. And it's a wonderful system because at K equals 2, the flow is so unstable that it turns turbulent at the Reynolds number of 12. A Reynolds number of 12 has nothing to do with IQ. So you can go from 8 to 16 to 32 to 64 to 128. It's a wonderful system that turns, it's so easy to resolve. The growth rate for K equals 1 means that in your box you have this one ABC flow. The K equals 2 you have 8 that are identical. And you think the same thing happens, except now that you have a shorter length scale, it should grow twice as fast. It's simply a matter of a rate of time. But it doesn't. It grows actually about 4 times as fast. And that's interesting. The reason is that it breaks the symmetry and it's able to find ways that are more efficient to let the field grow. And it's sort of constrained by the symmetry in this case. And then when they go to 3 and 4, it simply scales with K as it should. So you gain something from K to 1 to K to 2. But now, the crucial point is that this and that number, they're small. They're terribly small. Because the largest convergence rate at these other points, I think it's square root of 2, or something of the order of unity, much, much larger. No? And think about what it means, that the magnetic field grows as e to the eta t. But it means that either you're not diffusing this, right? And this is simply the rate that you have feedbacks. This is the case in over 90% of space, and actually in a fractional space that grows up to 100 when you increase the Reynolds number. Right? In a tiny fraction of space, diffusion is important, okay? And there you can, of course, get a lower growth rate simply because diffusion prevents the field from growing as it should. If you have the field perfectly parallel to the stretching direction, it's going to grow with the square root of 2 growth rate, and it doesn't. Okay? So we know from the outset that at that convergence point, we have very strong effects of diffusion. And it must be there, otherwise you cannot resolve this thing. And you must have sufficient diffusion so that your flux tube becomes fairly resolved. And the higher your numerical resolution, the smaller resistivity you can cope with. But this is perfectly resolved if you have the right type of diffusion. And we now understand that the rest of space cannot have an empty field aligned with the spectrum direction properly. Both are sort of oriented to get that growth rate, because that growth rate must apply all over space. And in most of space, diffusion is ignorable. And this growth rate is achieved simply by orienting the field differently. In that part of space, nothing, absolutely nothing, is different when you change the Reynolds number. I come back to that. That's a crucial point.
What's the value of the Lyapunov exponent?
Sorry?
What's the Lyapunov exponent?
Lyapunov exponent.
People have tried to relate this to the Lyapunov exponent, and there are different theories about fractions. It doesn't work. No. It's of the
norm. But how much is it?
It's probably known for ABC flows.
Someone has proven that at this first time. The Lyapunov exponent is a bracket. This has to be smaller. But it's quite a bit smaller. So in those regions where they do have chaos, the exponent is quite a bit larger than these growth rates.
Exponent has to be related not to the energy growth rate, but to the growth rate of logarithm of the...
Whatever. It's not the Lyapunov exponent that is relevant.
How the mode of maximum growth rate varies with the magnetic Reynolds number?
It's independent when you go to high Reynolds numbers. It decreases a bit first, from very low to, I think this probably is a plot of it for k equals 2. Like so.
What's the mode in which it's growing the most?
I'm going to show that in a while.
Okay.
And you know, the point here is that you can never prove a fast dynamo. Even if you go to 10,000 or 100,000, you can say that it's better evidence. That's bullshit, because there's no evidence at all if you're just looking at a curve like this. But if you understand what happens in that limit, and if all that happens at limit is the scaling, things get smaller and smaller and smaller. But they look the same, and they can be rescaled. Then you can, quote-unquote, prove a fast dynamo. That's what I'm going to do. So, let's see. I think I should go this thesis that it's taken from is available on the web, so maybe I should not waste the time by bringing it up here. But simply discuss these three points here. That we discovered by analyzing the work and the dissipation in the regime. But I actually need a very important figure. So I need to bring up that thesis. It's here. That's quite big, so it takes a little while to load. But the point has been well known for a long time. And if you look at the papers about the ABC dynamo, it's been pointed out several times, this difficulty in understanding. This comes, of course, and it came, of course, to begin with from the extended experiments where you really saw a forcing equation. So that you have a forcing that looks like the ABC flow, and then some viscosity on it. If viscosity is low, you simply get the ABC flow. If viscosity is high, you get that. And if you have it low, you get the turbulence. And I think it was Galloway, perhaps, who pointed this out in a paper first. And if you look at the work and the dissipation on a log scale as a function of time, but of course, they grow exponentially, they can do nothing else. Because they must grow as the energy grows. But the strange thing is that they grow like this, schematically. This is the work. This is the dissipation. So there's a small, tiny difference between the two. And that is what makes the dynamo grow. And the remark often made in the papers is, well, why is this difference so small? Why couldn't it as easily go the other way? And if the difference was the other way, then you'd have a decaying thing. So is it then perhaps a coincidence that you have a dynamo? How can you understand that these two are almost equal, but one wins a bit above the other? That's the key point. And we have a...
As long as you have two different Lyapunov exponents, you will also have the growth. That's a theorem.
Just try and find what this be. Pretty late. Let's start with the contrast. So that's the table where I'm quoting from on the page. And I think I got the picture right now. Let's see the other one. Let's see, I have the number here. Working two bars, that's 5.6. Okay, so, right, yeah. Here it is. Okay, so these are exactly the quantities involved. And now it's the turbulent case. Okay? And I told you that the turbulent case looks almost like the Langer case. Both rates are similar, of course. I should show you
how turbulent. Okay, how turbulent is what is the Reynolds number of
a variant? We have various kinds of Reynolds number. It's not important.
Sorry, what do you mean by the turbulent case?
Yeah, I'll show you that too.
What you're doing here, the ABC.
Yes, I'm doing the ABC, but this is forced ABC. People have done that before. Forced ABC, where you have a viscosity that regulates what happens. So this shows in brief what happens. If you have a Reynolds number, a flow rate, sorry?
Good feedback, right?
Yeah. This is simply the MHD equations in full, with a given forcing curve.
Well, we're not doing it.
And if the Reynolds number is just larger than 12, you get turbulence.
So we're not kinematic anymore?
No. This is dynamic. Two chapters in the thesis. But the same thing applies. And I can go back to the kinematic case to wrap up the argument. But this figure is good enough to have. It's about the same in the other case. So, with a turbulent Reynolds number, viscosity Reynolds number, not magnetic one, this happens. But if you put the forcing right to begin with, well, you have this amplitude. The kinetic energy is 1.5, because you have 1, 1, 1, and a factor of a half in front of the kinetic energy, that's 1.5, and it's laminar. At some point it turns turbulent, and the kinetic energy would drop very much, but we have a servo that kicks in to try and regulate the kinetic energy. So after some time it finds itself a new steady state. Not quite steady, it fluctuates a bit. But you can maintain the forcing so you have the same RMS velocity. And that's why we get this little bit funny growth rate. This dip here is why it's sort of turning on the turbulence. But notice that that growth rate and this growth rate are almost the same. Okay? So the growth rate is simply given by the large scale turnover time. And that's the clue that made us understand what's going on with the work and the dissipation. Because how can it be that this tiny difference, and here I'm showing the Lorentz work and the U dissipation. And it's this tiny difference that makes the magnetic energy grow, and where the difference is negative, the magnetic energy drops, of course. And this is a comparison between the numerical dBdt, the EVdt, and the actual one. So a perfect fit. It really is a conservative numerical code. And this is the ratio of Lorentz work to U dissipation. As you see, on the average, between 10 and 5%. Larger than the larger work than dissipation. And still, it's the difference that gives you something like a turnover time. But that tells us that the work itself must correspond to some very much shorter time scale. Huh? And what is that? Now, let me see if I can find a visualization of Maybe I'll just go back to here.
Okay, you made a comment about the force range function to keep a steady velocity. Do you have to actually increase the forcing?
Yes, of course, yes. And the interesting fact about the forcing is that how strong does it have to be? Okay. Normally when you decrease the viscosity, the forcing has to be decreased proportionally. Right? So the forcing is proportional to 1 over the Reynolds number. And you know, if you had a Reynolds number of 200, you can maintain it with a very weak force. Except the transturbine, it doesn't work. And now you can translate the necessary force to an efficient Reynolds number. That Reynolds number is about 10 to 15. Okay. So it corresponds to the critical one. It's not funny, huh?
Shouldn't the forcing, after a certain time and saturation, shouldn't it be steady? The forcing may have to input.
Yeah.
Because it's decaying down at the bottom.
Yeah, it's steady. Yeah.
So it is steady after.
It's steady and corresponding to a Reynolds number of about 50 one.
Okay.
Does the forcing have any random character or is it deterministic?
Sorry?
Does the forcing have any random character or is it deterministic?
It's totally deterministic. And it could be totally steady. It tries to regulate the
it's especially ABC flow, right?
Yes,
always.
Yeah, it's especially ABC flow.
And the amplitude is scaled.
And here you see the structures that form. I don't have too much time and there's not much point in going too much in detail, but this is well known from the literature. You find these double cigars. And around the convergence point, around the alpha points. And they're double because they have two polarities. So this one will have P plus going one way, and that one will have them going the other way. And in between you have a PSP connection that shoots loose feedlands down into the beta point. And that's the only way you can get feedback of feedlands there. And since every point in space has to grow like E to the A of T, you have to get feedlands back into the diverging beta points. That's why that P connection and this structure with double cigars is crucial and must be resolved. You're not allowed to let this become unresolved in the numerical scheme. And now I think I'm ready to get back to that new graph again, where I showed this. If you take the kinematic case now, the laminar case, it's much, much easier to understand and analyze because everything is static. So these X tubes, for example, are perfectly stationary. They don't fluctuate as we do in the program case. And now we can make the following simple thing with IDL. People who know IDL know that this is simple. We simply ask, where is the dissipation less than a tenth of a percent of the maximum? Okay? Let me say, how many elements of space that are filled? And the answer with a reasonable right resolution is that fills more than 90% of the volume. So everything which is closer than a factor of 1,000 to the maximum dissipation is less than 10% of space.
Is dissipation less or is 1% or more than 1%?
Dissipation
above.
I'm sorry, this is wrong.
Yeah, okay.
Below.
Okay. Well, okay. You can change it later.
I mean, who is responsible for a schedule of seminars that you have? Because maybe the boards will give you a short, maybe not lecture discussion on
this is actually below of 100%. And here's the key point. Attention. The key point is that in the remaining 10% where dissipation is high, the two, work and dissipation, are in perfect balance. You can add them up and you get something which is much, much smaller than the net work. The net work is what makes the dynamo grow. That occurs in the rest, the 90% of space. That's where the work occurs, and there's no dissipation. Good point? So there is balance between dissipation and work in the dissipated regions. And there is work net done, and all of the net work that is being done is done in the weak field regions. Strange, huh? No, it's not strange. It's perfectly obvious once you come to think about it. Because What's going on here is that, that's the one I want to have. What's going on here is that, as I told you before, the time scale of convergence towards these points is much shorter, corresponding to a growth rate of square root of 2. Which means that at these points you have to have dissipation balancing. Diffusion if you want, but really use dissipation if you think in kinematic terms, or in dynamic terms. So these things are growing, but they're growing steadily and slowly. So, to very good approximation, there's balance between the work being done by the converging flow. And it's a little bit unusual to think about work being done by a kinematic flow, but it's perfectly legal to evaluate. And that is being... this now is no surprise, because when you know that they're stationary, you know that they must balance. Now, work and dissipation must balance in that region, apart from a little difference that makes it grow. But that represents a small fraction of the work needed. Okay? And now all you have to do to prove, prove, unquote, that this is first dynamo is to realize that these structures are exactly the same if you increase the Reynolds number arbitrarily. All that happens is that they shrink with 1 over the Reynolds number to the 1 half power. And otherwise, the topology is exactly the same, and in an increasingly large volume of space that goes to towards 1, nothing changes. Namely, the field lines are being aligned exactly as they were aligned, and they're being packed exactly as they were being packed all the time, and that packing represents the night work. Now let me show you an ideal.
Can the packing scale the Reynolds number the same way?
I prefer to call it packing, so other people would call it stretching.
Oh, I'm sorry, but I don't understand.
Let me show you this demo and maybe...
I'm not sure that's really a proof, Arkin.
Where is the idea? Do
you need a proof?
No, we might not.
You personally think that this is something which is necessary to prove. Part of the first diagram
okay.
is kind of before.
You.
I'm trying to get everything up for it.
So here's a little idea of problem.
Yes, it's something possible.
Okay. And first, does it come up? Okay.
No.
First, let me spin it a bit and show you the structure of these eigenvectors. The yellow lines here are the main stretching eigenvectors.
Yeah, only just.
We're waiting for your argument to finish.
You will pick up scales. This is scales.
Notice in the meantime that there's a funny spiral here. So the minor eigenvectors are making up a spiral.
What third way?
And that has to do with the velocity of the thing.
Where do you see the spiral?
Starting here, for example, you can follow the thin. The thin bands are the minor eigenvectors. And you see the following spiral over to the other end?
Alright.
Tilt it a bit?
Yeah.
And you can find them all over the place.
How did you pick the points to plot this?
These are the points with maximum convergence or divergence. Actually, the stagnation points in this case. But it's not so good to refer to them as stagnation points because it's not significant that they are stagnation points. It's significant that they are the points of maximum convergence and divergence.
No, is this points or have you drawn
that? Yeah, it's points. If I spin it a bit, try and lock your eyes onto, for example, this cross here.
Yeah.
It's a cross with two yellow things going out. Diverting, stretching, and three weak ones going out. So that's where flow is coming in and it's being stretched along that. And here's where you see the triple symmetry. So there are actually four directions rather than three in space. And there's an intricate connection between all of these. So typically these cigars are pointing into somewhat of a triangle and they're feeding flux lines up against three other neighboring alpha points, but it takes too much to get into that. Let's just play a little demo instead here. So now I can set a number of feed lines in here, arbitrarily, just a sheet of feed lines, and just see what happens to them if I run. And it might be a good idea to skin this pig in the meantime. Now, pretty soon we have to zoom out here to get the picture.
Is the big box your periodic box?
Yeah, the big box is a K2. So that covers already the appearance of the IGC flow.
So then I get to see the...
let's stop it here. I'll spin it a bit.
So what's at the top should be coming in through the bottom, right?
It's a periodic flow, but also it's not, in this case, forced to be perfectly symmetric. It's a K=2. So the field can figure out ways of being larger than K=2, can be K=1.
Okay, so you have a total box that's K=1.
Right, and when you do the connectivity like here, you're not forced to periodicity. You know that, when you can draw the path through a perfectly periodic system, they don't come out the same place. That's right. Around in chaos.
Right.
So here, what happens is that these things get squeezed, you can see them getting squeezed towards these alpha points, and along the stretching eigenvectors. And then they get shoved out at the beta points. You see one down here? Here? That's sort of a part of a triangle. And as they do, they get squished up against the next convergence points, and they get stretched in between and shoved out into the next cell, and into the next one, into the next one. And to have an exponential growth, it's not enough to stretch these things linearly. You have to get a dent in it, and then you have to get a dent in the dent, and a dent in the dent in the dent. So on. That's what happens here. The longer you run, the more dents you get. And actually, my...
Did you say dent? Dent?
Yeah, dump, or whatever you
want. Like a dimple, or a turn, or what?
These things here. The fact that you push it out of the corner and it goes into the next cell, where it again goes into the corner. And I have only a finite number of points along here. And actually, to do this, I even have to remesh so that I maintain a constant distance between the points. And here it's now starting getting unresolved. It's not that the position of the points is getting inaccurate, it's just flopping in between. This is not solving the MHD equations, of course, it's just following beads. I'm just now kinematically moving points around and drawing lines between them. That can be done in real time with IDL. It does get a mess in the end, but that's the point. It does get a mess, but that's why I have that one. So I think I shouldn't spend more time on this ABC thing now, but go back to the main line of argument, which is... That clearly now we understand why the ABC flow dynamo works, and we have a high degree of certainty that it really is a fast dynamo because we know that the structure simply scales, becomes smaller and smaller and smaller.
You haven't actually shown us two pictures, and should really see by comparison four different round numbers, and then one wants to see the structures and rescale the structure according to the recipe that you figure out, and then make sure it's the same.
The next point here is that turbulent dynamos are almost the same. Once you force them to have a sufficiently high amplitude, then as I showed in that picture in the thesis, their growth rate is practically the same. And that tells us something extremely interesting, namely that it's the large scale stretching which is there in the Lambert flow and there in the turbulent flow. That determines the growth rate of a turbulent dynamo. A small scale turbulence has no importance. Because if it had, the turnover time of small scales is much shorter. So the growth rate of small scale stuff should be higher if they were dominating the growth rate. But they're not. And why is that? Well, what is
the far fetched? You have to show a turbulence spectrum. And you have to show what is the spectrum of the velocity strain.
Yes, sir.
And I'm sure that it really everything comes due to large scale. And then you may say that,
I don't have
to say that. To say that in turbulence it is the same thing in Lambert, you have to say what is turbulence. You have to say what is you call turbulence. Okay? So show me the spectrum of
I can show you afterwards. I have these snapshots available online. But the short bottom line of the story is that if you force something, we'll able to see force it. When it turns turbulent, if you go to 80 cubed already, 160 cubed, very nicely you have in Russian ranch. And it's a very good case of just ordinary isotropic turbulence. And it doesn't matter if we increase and increase and increase the resolution, the growth rate remains the same. It does not decay, it does not go down, like people in our cabinet would say. The larger the Reynolds number, the smaller the growth rate. That's correlation. Instead, the growth rate remains the same. The saturation level remains almost the same. It increases slightly first. And then, when I have sufficient Reynolds number, it doesn't increase anymore. So it's of the order of a tenth of the kinetic energy in this case. In other cases, we have the two about equal, and in contract cases where the magnetic energy is larger than the kinetic energy. But clearly, this thing about scaling with the magnetic Reynolds number is just garbage.
And what is prompt?
And the limit of large Reynolds number, these things do not depend on the Reynolds number, neither on the dynamic one, the viscosity one, or the magnetic one.
What is prompt number? Diffusivity is less than viscosity.
Yes. If the diffusivity, the viscosity is larger than the resistivity, you tend to get higher magnetic energies.
And now you claim,
as you would expect.
Now you claim that if you have one or two decades of turbulent cascade, then the growth rate of magnetic field will be the same.
Yes.
Then you have the first condition that I would love to see pictures of.
Okay, I'll show you afterwards.
So what
is found that when you force the velocity to be the same RMS velocity, you maintain a growth rate which is given by the large scale turnover time.
When in your forced calculations, you say, when you have the ABC as only a force in view of the full MHC dynamo,
yes,
that's when you're getting, as you reach saturation magnetic Reynolds number, a point at which the growth rate does not increase as you increase the Reynolds
number. That's
okay. Now the question that would then arise as far as applicability to the real world could be, yes, that might be true, but how long does it take to get to that state? It could be that as your magnetic Reynolds number gets larger and larger and larger, that the time for which the reconnection for the diffusive effects to become important is going to be later and later and later. And so yes, eventually you'll get to this state where it's growing. And that...
Well, there's no problem with
these two figures.
I'm so much surprised, but fluid Reynolds number, the growth rate is independent, because we used to think that what really determines your growth rate is the largest velocity gradient. And as you increase Reynolds number, normally, as you decrease viscosity, then your largest gradient grows, and then
right.
You would expect that your growth rate
of what happens,
and you just keep resistivity, and it is very small, smaller than everything. And now there is a claim that the growth rate of dynamo is independent of the largest velocity gradient, which increases when velocity decreases. And that is astonishing, and I would love to see that.
That's just about what happens.
You just have two claims, Arthur. You're making these grand claims on the basis of a coincidence.
I think it's best if I finish this presentation in a reasonable sort of flowing fashion. Otherwise, it's going to be hacked up.
You can have
the audience, but I wouldn't mind with the audience to go through the argument.
Never a consideration, actually, but okay.
Let me just show what happens here. In the laminar growth rate, in the laminar growth phase, okay, if you increase the resolution, so you increase the Reynolds number, what happens is that immediately things get about half as small, half as large, and therefore you immediately jump up in kinetic energy, but as a trivial effect. And if you renormalize with that jump here, you find that the growth before and after changing the Reynolds number is perfectly aligned. So all you get is a smaller flux tube, and the smaller flux tube has a higher mean energy, because the filling factor comes in as one order of the filling factor, right? Okay. The energy growth is one of the filling factor, and the average thing is that the energy grows if you have a tinier fraction with the same flux in. And this is at the laminar phase. And when you get to the turbulent phase, if you start from a snapshot here, which with a certain resolution, and you increase the resolution, but the same thing happens again, that the snapshots get smaller. To the extent that they're dominated by diffusion, they get smaller. If they're dominated by forces, they will not get smaller. But if diffusion is still important in determining the size, you get a small increase. This is 10-15%, and in the underground something like 5%. Whereas in the previous laminar case, you get a factor of 2.7. That's when you're dominated by diffusion. But here you're dominated by Lorentz forces mostly. And we've continued this for a long, long time. And it fluctuates a bit, sometimes get a little bit below, but on the average it's about 5-10% larger.
What was 2.7 that you just showed us?
That's in the in the exponentially growing laminar section to begin with.
That's the time constant, 2.7?
No, it's the factor that the energy pops up immediately when you increase the resolution. The factor with which you have to renormalize to compare a low resolution and a high resolution case. The same flux, if you shrink it down to...
is that a factor of 2 in resolution? I mean,
it's a factor of 2 in resolution.
Same Reynolds number?
Same grid Reynolds number. Of course, it's twice as high photo Reynolds number.
So you remesh on a smaller mesh.
Yes. You remesh, all that happens is that the flux gets thinner.
At the same time, you change all the viscosities and all the resistance.
Yes, yeah, so you maintain the grid Reynolds number. And when a flux tube gets half as big, the magnetic field gets twice as big, the energy gets 4 times as big, and therefore the average energy gets 2 times as big. So you can see that it shrank a bit more than a factor of 2. And that effect is totally trivial and must be taken away before you can compare the...
You're saying this is your large-scale energy?
This is the mean energy of the whole thing.
Oh, okay, so you're getting it dominated by given directions. It's not isotropic.
No, that's extremely intermittent. But when you measure the mean field, the mean energy, you get this trivial jump. And it's a totally uninteresting effect. But this effect is interesting, that when you are in the saturation regime, you get a small increase which is perfectly understandable because diffusion gets smaller. But to the extent that forces are determining the structures, nothing happens. So in the limit, nothing would happen if you had enough.
This calculation started at t equals 0, presumably. Right.
This calculation started from the lower resolution one with a remesh. And therefore, you actually have exactly the same.
Before time equals 95 in the lower resolution, you have a similar fluctuations of.
You have similar fluctuations of energy.
What time did that start?
Because you have the same structures. Okay?
And what time did that start, that sort of fluctuation? You're showing after it's evolved. Did it start at time equals 30, time equals 60?
You mean this one here?
Yeah, that
this
one.
This is a local one. It's
always going on. Is that the point?
It's always going on, yeah. Up and down. And I think there is a
It took a certain amount of time before that. Regular sort of oscillations or chaotic sort of oscillations.
Here you have the same thing on a global scale.
Okay.
And here's the jump that happens if you just increase the resolution.
Okay. And then the dashed line is?
The dashed line is the low resolution case.
Very low resolution.
Yeah, well, not very low. It's I think Reynolds number 200 and cranking up to 400.
So it takes up to about time equals 80 for the magnetic energy to build up for the Reynolds number 200 case, and then it starts this fluctuation on the order of 1.
Yeah. And here it's about a tenth of the kinetic energy. And that's what it remains like in this particular for this particular flow.
What's really important that you need to do for something like this is you need to do a Reynolds number 400 case starting from time equals 0 and see how it builds up to...
We've done that.
You have?
We've done that, yes.
And does it compare to
the same.
As the Reynolds number 200
yes,
case?
Yes, it does.
It doesn't reach, that saturation time at a later time?
No. It reaches a slightly earlier time. So. Very, very slightly earlier times.
Okay, that's encouraging.
Yes. And I think I should skip this one. You can find this on the web. It's a curious exacting position diagram. All you have to do is to take away the cosine terms in the ABC flow. And what develops is something funny. You have this initial laminar state, and then it develops turbulence. This is the ABC flow, and it keeps growing very rapidly. But then when it saturates, turbulence dies out.
Now, force the previous force, the ABC force that we know has helicity built into the force.
Yes, but this one doesn't.
This one does not. It has zero helicity?
Zero net helicity, but I think it has local helicity.
Okay, the question is zero net helicity.
Yes.
Okay,
I'll explain why this is important later.
And it jumps out as a perfect equalization dynamo. Same amplitude B and U. And very, very nearly parallel. And the more you increase the Reynolds numbers, the more parallel they become.
Yeah.
It's a simple Lanner L solution. And probably in some limit they would break down the turbulence again. But for a while at least they have this window with equal U and B.
Are you going to go back and show us more about the turbulence in this ABC flow case? I mean, I understand your claim. Your claim is that even though it's turbulent, it's the large scales which are doing the work. Yes, I can go back and show you that figure, which is the very crucial figure, which is the important one. Let's see if I can go back. What is your spectrum of magnetic energy look like in your turbulent case?
This is the crucial figure. This is a case where you have perfect laminar flow from time 0 to time 30 or something. And then here, turbulence kicks in. And the server is not very good at keeping the speed to begin with. Because you can't regulate the force too rapidly.
Do you have diagnostics of the turbulence itself?
I can't show you here, but I have to.
The spectrum changes from something very steep, like k to the minus 4.
I can show you this afterwards.
Or time equals 40, and then right afterwards it starts growing to something more like a turbulent spectrum.
We have a high order code. Sixth order derivatives, third order time step, etc. That allows us to go quite close to the limit, so that our power spectrum typically looks like this. Power of the universe. If we drive to the lowest wave numbers, back here, table 1, you get really a very nice power spectrum order to begin with. There's not much of a bump here.
That's the velocity.
Yeah, this is the power velocity. Yeah? And then, if you have a Nyquist frequency or Nyquist wave number here, then typically at a factor of about 5, Km divided by 5, we start to see a drop off of the spectrum.
You don't realize it?
Sorry?
You don't have the realizing
formula?
I don't
have. Realizing? No, it's not a spectrum code. It's a real. Staggered mesh, real life factor physics code. We do supersonic problems with this code. So there's no. This just has ordinary, perfectly constant viscosity and resistivity. We have all kinds of fancy turbulent things, or rather, I should say, shock capturing things. But we don't use them here. It's a constant coefficient.
So what's the problem?
And you can. The question is always, if you have a resolution of 128, how far can you push the Reynolds number? In our experience, is that you can push it about 6 times the number of grid zones on the job. That's a conservative measure. So the Reynolds number of about 800 with 128 points, without developing problems. And at that point, you have something like so. So this drop off starts a factor of 5 from the boundary. That means if you have 128 points, you have about an order of magnitude of scaling here.
So what should you slope?
Sorry?
What's the slope of the curvature?
5 thirds.
5 thirds. Okay, and where's the helicity spectrum look like?
I haven't checked.
This is at times after 80 years or 100, so it's going to be 5 thirds.
This is at times after 40 or something. This is where turbulence kicks in.
Oh, really? That
and
really?
In pretty short order, you get a good spectrum out of it.
Somewhere early on, the spectrum is very steep.
But the point is that the growth rate is the same before and after.
I understand. How it can happen.
Why are people surprised about this? Well, people are surprised about this because they didn't used to make these experiments. They used to make experiments that had a constant forcing. And then when turbulence kicks in, you get a much, much lower velocity. And the Reynolds number they put on your figure is not the real Reynolds number, because the velocity has dropped. This is the label, it's not the Reynolds number. And one needs to do that constant Reynolds number, compare the same Reynolds number.
I said that. I understand that there is no really contradiction, I guess I understand the data, because
you have turbulence change, you put the magnetic field, and then you look how it goes. What you really have, you start, and your turbulence cascade develops, and of course it's a large scale turnover time for cascade to develop. And this is exactly the time for magnetic field to grow.
Yes.
And in this case, there is no contradiction.
No.
But sure, if you have turbulence, and then you put magnetic field small population into it, and you look what is the growth rate of the cascade, then it will be determined by the smallest scale of by the largest velocity.
Until it has
to be careful here.
And why is it that the faster turnover times on the smaller scale do not show up in the growth rate? Why do the small turnovers not give you fast growth?
Because your magnetic field, because they are not formed yet. I mean, your turbulence is formed during that very large scale turnover time.
After turbulence has become active, when you have turbulence,
because most of the energy from a large scale.
Sorry?
I think it's because most of the energy is.
No, you don't care about energy, you care about velocity gradient. Most of the velocity gradient is at small scale.
The explanation is
that typical time scale is.
All of the small scales are being carried along by larger scales. The largest scale is the only one that is not being carried along and distorted by an even larger scale.
If you already have feedback, I was talking about kinematics only. For kinematics, it's a statement. You put small magnetic field, then the growth rate will be determined by the smallest scale of turbulence. Period, I mean.
But
as long as you have feedback and the small scale already gives the balance, then of course it's on the large scale of the growth.
But listen, I would like to come to the conclusion about the solar dynamo from this. The conclusion that we must draw about the solar dynamo is that the solar dynamo growth rate is not determined by some funny coincidence between, you have to crank down the alpha effect to get the right time scale, we just use turbulent alpha, the thing is much too fast, and so on. That's not the case. It's not some funny combination of factors. It simply is the large scale turnover time of the sun. The differential rotation determines the growth scale of the solar dynamo. And the small scale stuff is perturbations that are relatively uninteresting. And let me just, in closing, you show you the two 3D renderings that I was planning to show. It's already gone a bit over what I intended to have here. Or rather, maybe I should show the demo of this in IDL because it's more interesting than the rendering. The rendering looks more or less like Axis the other day. And note that even in our models that have too much overshoot region, most of the toroidal class is inside the convection zone. Now we know how to scale the overshoot region to the sun. It becomes much, much smaller. Conclusion. In the sun, a tiny fraction of the toroidal flux resides in the overshoot region. Most of it is inside the convection zone, and it can be there. It can be there for a reason that I'll show you with this ideal demo, if I remember where I put it. Yes, of course, it's in the wrapped up the ideal. So here you have a polytrop and a velocity field which is highly schematic. It's perfectly symmetric with respect to up and down. The plan form in the plane is a simple sinusoidal. I can change it into a 3D like so. It's still perfectly symmetric. There's a sinusoidal product in the horizontal plane. But in the vertical direction, here you have something that's similar to the bottom of the solar convection zone, just a 3/2 polytrop with a temperature ratio of 1:100. And you can go to 1:2000 and just doesn't change much. Now, as a simple consequence of mass conservation, if you take a plane anywhere here, the density is much, much lower up here. It means that everything that goes up, almost everything that goes up, has to turn over. And the result, if you do the same trick as before, this is basically the same program. I did this one first and the other one later. This is what happens to a plane of feed lines starting out somewhere in the convection zone, doesn't matter where I start them. In about one turnover time, they all go down to the bottom. Purely kinematic effect. Has nothing to do with asymmetries between up and down, thermal plumes, anything like that. It's simply a kinematic effect. I can stop it, I can spin it. That's what it looks like. And it's pretty thin. Thin pillow down there. And what we find in the 3D, let me see if I now have it. Yeah, I think I have it here. Actually, I need to get to the desktop like so. And then I can pull, hopefully, let's see, could it be this one?
Okay, they come up again, right? So, can you just carry on the simulation and then show how they get out again?
Well, it's sort of not relevant because in the real case you don't have closed flow lines. So I don't want to get into that discussion and take that priority. What happened? Yeah, okay, here it's coming. Yes, this is it. So here's a 3D rendering of the tools. Yeah, I need to focus on it, like so. Tilt it a bit, like so, and move it out a bit, like so. And we're now looking at a caricature, a cartoon of the solar dynamo. Cartesian box with shearing velocities in the x direction. So the velocity in that direction, which we could call the y direction, varies with sinusoidally, like this. So you shear whatever you have into strong, quote-unquote, toroidal plastids. And these are renderings of constant magnetic energy. And look, they're all inside the convection zone. And they're being held down there. This is a dynamic convection simulation. And nothing changes with time here. It's being held down there. Unless we have an open boundary, then things happen.
What do you mean by toroidal? I don't see toroidal.
It's just a joke. No? It's the direction that shear tends to stretch things into. That's how it's defined. On the sun, we have the differential rotation, and it stretches things in toroidal direction. Here we start with a poloidal, quote-unquote, field, and you can still find it below the convection zone. There you find it nicely arranged in that direction, where the yellow field and the convection zone. And again, that, just like Axel, we have a shear inside the convection zone that vanishes below the convection zone. And then, you develop these structures inside the convection zone. And we haven't been able to find where the limit is, where they become buoyantly unstable. We've gone to 30 kilogauss, and that's not enough to make them pop up to the surface. And I think I should basically stop here and see the last point I had. Check that I don't forget important points. The last point was, the field reversal. That's a very nice mechanism that Alphon Balakoyan invented maybe 6 or 8 years ago or something. And we can find some evidence for it. We can't really confirm it yet, but we can find some weak evidence for it in the simulations. It takes a bit of hand waving to explain it, but there is a figure in the thesis, but it's faster to draw it than to find the figure here. Ant's elegant and simple idea was the following. And we all know that in the sun we have these toroidal gas systems that pop out loose. And when they get to the surface, we see the sunspots. And there's a well-established observed law that the leading spots tend to come out closer to the equator, and the following ones tend to be farther away. And this can be easily understood as a consequence of the Coriolis force. And that has been used by people to model, start out with some flax rope, and you try to model that tilt, the tilt law. And you can then conclude that the field has to be on the order of 100 kilograms to fit these tilt laws. And if you have that, it fits pretty well. So probably that's what it is. I have a sort of system of about 100 kilograms and things pop up to the surface like that. But notice now, if you have this guy over there, and further down the line, you have another one.
I mean, that argument is based on the thin flux tube of Dr. Eunice.
No, it's not. Our argument is not based on the thin flux tube approximation.
The tilt?
The 100 kilogauss models are based on that.
Yeah,
well, and they're in many respects perhaps too naive. But I think they come up with a reasonable value for the necessary field. Because that follows only from a balance between tension and Coriolis forces. But let's forget about that, because this argument does not depend on that being right. It simply depends on, my sketch is perhaps not so good, but this is at the bottom of the convection, so we have this flux flow system. You should think of it as really a very chaotic and I think a cap and you have a fractal perhaps. But notice now what happens. If you have some kind of connectivity between this guy, who is the following guy closer to the pole of the leading system, and this guy, which is the leading one in the arm that's down the line, they make up above the surface, you can forget about connectivity. Above the surface, fields just reconnect. Observationally, we know that they don't care about who they came up with, they just reconnect to whatever is available. So you can think of them as free floating upper ends of something. If you have connectivity below, you find a U with the leading edge further away from the equator, and the following one closer. This is reversed. It's reversed compared to the normal orientation, where you have a spiraling field starting out, and you know, it's wound towards the equator by the differential rotation. You have finding gliding field here. And now you've got reverse. This will have a differential rotation, this will be bound the other way, and the field will be turned. And we see some evidence of that in the models, but we don't have sufficient resolution to really prove it. But I think it's very suggestive that Hall was actually right, and he's been right several times before, so why not? Okay, well that's
the... Is this a spherical model or a calculator? You said you see it in the calculations.
We see it in the calculations, but as I've told you, the calculations are merely cartoons. They don't have the right spherical geometry answer. So, okay, I tried to hit the short, but I didn't quite succeed, sorry.
There was a section that popped up on the page that said dependence on magnetic Prandtl number.
Yes.
And I just wondered what the results were for the dependence.
The results are as no you would expect.
But I just
if you increase the viscosity, the Prandtl up the ratio of magnetic field to Prandtl.
But is it ultimately still determined by the outer scale? The growth rate.
We have the active project check this in convection. And my firm conviction is that when you go to sufficient resolution, whatever it is, magnetic stuff or thermal stuff, the Prandtl number doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter what the Prandtl number is, the sun is 10 to minus 8. Because it's symptomized as times a huge number. So at some scale, at some very small scale, of course, you find that things are different because the magnetic or the Prandtl number is low.
But as long as the larger scale is significant.
On the larger scale, why the heck should we care about that?
I guess I would agree.
I'm surprised that no one has studied this before.
I think these guys, the Conley and Shepard, those guys are doing it between, but they're only doing it in the range between the viscous scale and the resistive scale.
And what?
They're actually studying the effect of increasing the Prandtl number.
Uh-huh.
But the thing is, they don't have enough dynamic range to look about what happens way, way on the outer, on the larger scale of the surface, which is the interesting question.
Yes.
I mean, you must look at quantities whose power spectrum dominated by the large scales. For example, the velocity power spectrum or something separate. I mean, velocity properties, of, for example. But if you look, for example, at vorticity theory, you would not, of course, converge.
Okay.
So if you look at our master, isn't it called the master
I mean, they...
And we'll be primarily dependent.
They do have velocity dominated at large scales, but they start actually at the viscous scale, just outside the viscous scale, and look at the resistance, look at, you know, in between the resistance scale and the viscous scale. In between the viscous scale and the resistance scale. And they do start out with a pumping in the spectrum, which is dominated on the viscous scale, but that's their outer scale.
So what are they looking at? I mean, what are the quantities they...
They're looking at the energy saturation. Energy.
Yeah, but that should really converge. That should be independent, actually.
Well, they find that the peak in the energy is...
this is really strange.
Well, although...
I don't think that's correct. I mean, not at least in the long run. I mean, maybe that's the short, maybe that hasn't been run for a long time.
Well, that's what they find. I mean, it depends on exactly what we're talking about, but I mean, they find that, you know, that if you have...
One thing like Charlie was unhappy with was his postdoc is contributing entirely without any. I would be really worried about Tasha at this evening.
That may be an interesting unit on right, of course, look at the share.
That's
the kind of thing that you find.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I find is that if you have such a magnetic energy, even though the magnetic prime number is very large, it still has it can still do things to the velocity on small scales for at least a short time.
Yes, which is why this which is why this is cutting off at the viscous scale, it's cutting off
at much later
between, right?
No, even much later. Probably very close.
Okay, very close. But they do claim that this, as you know, increase this, the ratio goes up over EK. This goes up as you increase.
I don't think that's right. EM over EK, primary dependent? No.
Sorry,
is it that quality primary?
Yeah.
But
what they don't do, see, this is, they don't have enough
energy. If you've got one plus one electric prime number, then the ratio of kinetic, magnetic energy is linear.
Okay, good.
Straight linear.
Yeah, that's more or less consistent with what they're finding in this range. But I guess the question, which seems sort of interesting, if you take a magnet, you know, you plot this down, this is going down on something like this, and then there's a turbulence scale, which is then the K1 or whatever is way up here.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question is, how does this effect translate into the, you know, the spectra as you go way out to the very much outer scale?
Uh-huh.
Which seems intuitively, this shouldn't matter that much. I mean,
one problem is that it must run for very long times. I mean, you want to run for a long time that the magnetic spectrum really has to build up to its large scale.
Let's suppose even that they've done this in this small range.
So I don't think that
I think they would argue.
Actually, what kind of forcing do they have? They have some funny forcing, right?
Right, they have some forcing, actually, which
that is enough.
It is. The forcing is now, their forcing is just around the viscous, because they only consider this range.
Around the viscous?
Yeah.
And here?
This is the viscous scale. Okay. Mm-hmm. And they only consider more or less this range. But they do adjust the forcing to keep the velocity steady, so they increase mm-hmm. the forcing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but at which scale?
Well, the large scale in their problem really is only...
Okay, but I mean, you still have...
That's the problem.
This is
what? Right. Yeah, that's the problem. You really should have a different compromise. If you have a compromise where the viscous scale has some leeway to the energy container scale.
Yeah, that's right. So there's not enough dynamic range or anything to go up. So I was just trying this would be the input.
If you slightly smaller Prandtl number, you can do it.
Okay.
But that's they're going to very extreme Prandtl numbers.
Right, I see. Yeah.
And if you just sell a bit of that, they can buy a bit of...
more dynamic range.
Yes.
But it seems to me that, you know, to really
the next question is probably that everyone is interested in, being, how is this different? If you have 10 orders of magnitude, or a number of orders of magnitude between the viscous scale and the energy input scale, which is just restated at this point, mm-hmm. then how does the spectrum in saturation depend on this transmount rate? That's sort of interesting. And perhaps also, how does this panel look initial seed field you put in here?
But another angle on their work also is what would happen if they applied it to the solar wind? They would conclude that the viscous scale of the solar wind would be like an astronomical union, mm-hmm. because that's the free mean
mass. Astronomical union.
Yeah,
unit.
An astronomical union. AU.
Oh, right. AU.
Yeah.
I okay.
Okay.
Right.
And it's not. So,
yeah.
I wonder how relevant this is really to...
Is this the same with the IAU, I think?
Is it? Might, yeah. Well, yeah. It's
that's what... That's what
yeah, yeah, right. So that's what I'm saying. If you have magnetic fields at small scale, they will affect velocity regardless of the scale. And they will do that on a short time.
Yeah.
It will affect everything.
Okay.
And regardless of the viscosity. So it can do a lot of things to the velocity spectrum, even if the viscosity is large.
I mean, the thing is, you know,
just
it's
remarkable. I mean, you can, so even if you have lots of small scale structures, even though from another extreme.
If you have many orders, I mean, I think those guys would actually, in response to solar wind thing, they would say that they're working more in the context of the galaxy.
This is.
But, of course. Which is, but the solar wind, you're right.
Yeah, but they're arguing that the viscous scale in the galaxy is 10 to 16 centimeters.
Right.
A hundredth of, 300 of a parsec. That's ridiculous.
It's probably large. Well, it depends on, I guess.
Yeah, that must be ridiculous.
So there's no turbulence down to the scale of a star?
Exactly.
How about in the soup of Sarah?
The thing is here. I mean,
so how does it, how do you get this large discovery?
Well, that's the main part.
They have probably just the wrong equation, right? I mean, if the mean free path is larger than
normally the mean free path of particles in the solar wind is like from the sun to the earth. But nevertheless, that's not what happens. Somehow the small scale turbulence is able to act as a resistivity scattering agent.
Yeah. I mean, for example, if you have an atmosphere, let's take the upper atmosphere of the Earth, at 80 kilometers high.
Yeah.
There you have mean free path of let's take the protostellar disk, for example, they have a large, that is probably the thickness of the thing, of course.
Yes.
And that's really not a problem to determine the effect of viscosity at all. It's the real viscosity, and the real viscosity is determined by then the size of the body, I think it is. Something.
There's a different equation.
It's a totally different equation. This equation with a third times Laplace is just totally wrong. You have something like a Chapman. And
it's got
viscosity, for example.
Uh-huh.
And
can you explain how it works in physical terms?
No, I don't think so. But I think the equation that you how do you remember these things? So normally you would think you have air times c plus c is the of sound, but that should really be actually the minimum of A and L times C. And A is in the size of the body.
So
if you have a body which falls, for example, through a tenuous atmosphere.
Do you say tenuous or tenuous?
Tenuous.
Atmosphere. Then this body has a certain radius A.
Yeah.
And if you say you have a mean free path, for example, L, much bigger than that.
Oh, okay.
That's the minimum.
Yeah. That makes sense, but what does it tell you about just the gas in the medium? That doesn't have a body to...
You don't really lose the concept of viscosity. So then the Reynolds number, of course, if you're given by... So if you're in this case, then it's really given by A times C.
And you know, it's in some generalized
sense... It's a Mach number.
It seems to me that their argument would fall if there were a collision, this effective wave particle coupling that was acting.
Yeah, that's probably what it is.
Their argument is based on collisional interaction, Coulomb.
Which, of course, you don't have if it's tenuous.
If it's tenuous, there may be a better argument for some kind of wave-particle interaction, which gives you a different scale.
Yeah, but still, you probably really have very small viscosities. Yeah. I mean, it's really ridiculous.
Yeah, it sounds.
Yeah.
That's better. Yeah. That's something that's very important.
So it's totally screwed up here. I mean, a guy like Hülshoff shouldn't have done it himself, but.
Diffusion.
Well, of course, in the stellar medium, which is over in Milton, you can always argue that the Milton part is related to the action plus the intermittent pieces of a macula.
Mm-hmm.
And they will be on very small scales. So therefore, again, you will have viscosities that are characterized by, if you want, the free atoms of the tenuous mediums to be hitting those small bodies. No? Mm-hmm. Bodies called that part of dense gas.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can be a million or more times more dense.
Mm-hmm.
And they're plowing through a thin gas.
Right, I mean, then you have, what are you saying? So first of all, you have really this agent.
Yeah, you have an arbitrary small head.
Yeah, right.
Down to where it doesn't fragment anymore.
Right.
That is determined by where the maximum falls below unity. Down to the scale where the maximum is supersonic, you have fragmentation. At least down to that scale, there is no importance on the spot.
And this really is a ridiculously small realm again, right? But that's really because you're looking at the realm relative to a small body, of course,
yes.
In a tenuous medium. So that is probably correct.
Yeah.
So if you're on a larger scale, of course, then you have. And this scale should then be probably something like the magnetic relation length or something, if you have turbulence.
Mm-hmm. So who is going to be coming here with the temperature?